This is episode 145 of That Shakespeare Life. Today's episode is brought to you by Experience Shakespeare. Experience Shakespeare is the membership arm of That Shakespeare Life that offers you monthly digital history activity kits that let you try at home the history you learn about on the show. They work like science labs for history. Stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Joe Stevenson, the editor of The Dutch Lady. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare and his contemporaries includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
Londoners, for instance, did drink water, but very much in moderation. It was all about in moderation because, for one, their main river was absolutely filthy, disgusting. So you have all these companies back in the 17th century, these new river companies, various London companies, looking for freshwater springs in and around the city.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
Ale was a popular drink in Shakespeare's London, due in part to the undrinkable nature of the water from the nearby Thames River. The fear of water and superstitions about drinking it extended well beyond England's capital city and extended even over the Atlantic Ocean to the colonies of early American settlers, who, coming from England, brought with them a surprising opinion about water in general. New England colonists in the early 17th century arrived with a fear of what they called clear water, believing as a result of their experience with waterways like the Thames that plain water was dangerous. Here to share with us some of the experiences and opinions about water held by 16th to 17th century England, including the stories by 16th century writer Richard Hawkins, who described Native Americans as mermaids because of their magic ability to both swim and treat water as their natural element, is our guest, Vaughn Schribner. Vaughn Schribner is an associate professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas. He is the author of The Happy Effects of These Waters, Colonial Mineral Spas, and British Civilizing Mission, as well as two books, Incivility, Urban Taverns, and Early American Civil Society from NYU Press, and Merpeople, A Human History from Reaction Books. In addition to various articles and book chapters which cover the environmental, social, and political history of the British Empire. Hello, Vaughn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I'm excited to talk with you today, Cassidy.
We think of early America as being 18th century and well after Shakespeare, but the records from English colonists interacting with Native Americans and experiencing clear water for the first time experiences started in the early 17th century, I think. So would these have been reported back to England during Shakespeare's lifetime?
Definitely. So there was a real thirst and a hunger for knowledge about these strange new worlds, North and South America and the West Indies. Not just West, but also in the Far East, as you know, 16th century Englishmen would have understood it. It was considered this exotic place with exotic peoples and a place where Englishmen could push the boundaries of their knowledge. And this is something I study a lot from the 17th through the 18th centuries, are these Englishmen, eventually Britons, going to this new world and both trying to recreate their society in that new world, but also realizing that things weren't the same here. Everything's not going to translate so neatly. We see that very well in, you know, Captain John Smith. He has a bunch of best-selling books when he comes back from his exploits in Virginia. He uses this to become a celebrity. It's not just because people want to know about him, but it's that they want to know about where he's been. You know, who are these Native Americans or savages, I put in quotes, as they would have called them at the time. What are their lives like? What can they tell us about the nature of humanity? He publishes his first work in 1608, and then he has another 1612 book. But then 1624, he has a reprint, and he adds Pocahontas to that one. For instance, Pocahontas had never been in there. So he's changing his works, and many other people are, as more interaction goes on with the new worlds. And you also have these people who are moving over to the new world who want people to come over there. So they're constantly talking about the natural world in America, because so much is different over there, or at least it's perceived to be different, which is something else that I work on a lot. And finally, Shakespeare mentions the New World of Bermuda in The Tempest, which I'm sure a lot of Shakespeare people know. So Shakespeare himself would have been well informed on the idea of the New World, maybe not perhaps the particulars, but these ideas of exoticism, savagery, exploration, exploitation. It would have been very much in his mind's eye as he's writing, as he's, you know, attending plays, meeting people, reading books. It's really this big boom in the public sector in England.
Vaughan quotes William Strachey, who in 1612 wrote that, quote, "The Indians' drink is as the Turks clear water." Vaughan, were the Europeans surprised to see people who drank water as a matter of course?
Yes. And as a matter of course is the clear thing here. No pun intended, I suppose. There. Londoners, for instance, did drink water, but very much in moderation. It was all about in moderation because, for one, their main river was absolutely filthy, disgusting. So you have all these companies back in the 17th century, these new river companies, various London companies, looking for freshwater springs in and around the city. The issue is that, for one, it's hard to keep fresh water fresh or clear very long in the city with the multitude of animals. They have to literally close. There is a river that runs under Fleet Street in London that they just had to close. They had to close it off because it was so disgusting. You have these companies trying to bring in this clear water. Also, interestingly, they didn't think of water being clean the way we do. They didn't understand, you know, microbiology and that kind of thing. They thought that you needed to keep mud out of it, keep leaves and weeds out of it. That made it clean. They were very concerned with how it smelled. They would try to fence off these little canals they created so livestock and people couldn't get into it. But still, even with that water, then it would be carted into people's homes for at-home use. But even then, people did not regularly drink clean or clear water, as they would have called it. So they also look at these Native Americans and the fact that they do drink clean water regularly. Obviously, they're not as civilized as us because they don't understand distilling and fermentation. They drink this base substance, and therefore that makes them base people. Colonists and Europeans are constantly they're associating Native Americans with the wilderness, the savage in the wilderness. And they, on the other hand, are civilized, urban, advanced. They kind of say that, like, well, they're drinking this cold water, but that doesn't mean that they're superior. It actually means they're behind us because they must be some base creatures that can drink this otherwise foul brew, for instance.
We know that ale was popular in Shakespeare's lifetime, often due to the fact that, as you say, the Thames was nasty and undrinkable, and water had this reputation of being potentially dangerous. But Vaughan, did English settlers have a reverence for alcohol over water in their understanding of what was medically healthy for a person to consume?
I have an article separate from this one forthcoming about how, especially by the 18th century, but the ideas of this coming around the 17th century, there's a big deal, for instance, a big difference, for instance, of clear water versus mineral water. Clear water was considered the most pure, but not medicinal at all. Mineral water, oftentimes, they spoke about mineral water, especially these rising scientists, in the same way they spoke about alcohol. They'd use terms like fermentation, distill. They thought that both could intoxicate you. They trusted alcohol way more than mineral water or water in general in the 17th century. It was easily produced. They knew it was safe. It never hurts that it made you drunk. That's something people have to, you know, scientists didn't like to talk about that, but they liked the inebriating part of it. It gave you valuable calories, especially if you were like a lower class person who's working all day. But I would say that in the 17th century, they definitely had a reverence of alcohol as medicine, way over water. They would feed alcohol to babies. Women would use alcohol as a facial cleanser, but there are different sorts of alcohol. So wine, for instance, and ale were seen as more healthy than like hard spirituous liquors, as they would call it. By the 18th century, this gets a lot murkier. And oftentimes scientists are speaking kind of out both sides of their mouth. They're saying at one sense that alcohol is healthy and water is not healthy, or water is healthy, alcohol is not healthy, mineral water is healthy. And it all goes back to kind of this idea of like health is an idea. It's a mutable concept. We're still wrestling with it today. One day, an article comes up that says, you should drink red wine. It's good for you. The next day, alcohol is bad. They say anything with coffee. We have all these fad medical diets all the time. We haven't changed. And our idea of health and what is healthy is constantly just evolving or devolving, however way you want to look at it.
Vaughn cites the inexperience of early English settlements in dealing with clean water as one reason the benefits of clear drinking water did not immediately take hold in the English mindset. Specifically citing Virginia Governor Sir Francis Wyatt, Vaughn, what was their experience which led to what Wyatt called a, quote, inexcusable error of drinking water that happened along the banks of the James River?
Yeah, this gives us back to these kind of water companies in London in some ways, because they should have learned their lesson in this way. These Englishmen knew better than to drink this water that's in these low marshy areas, as it was in Virginia. This water was also brackish in the James River, so it would have tasted and smelled salty, which they should have known better than. And so according to kind of early modern parlance, one's environment was very important in how it affected you and the water around you. So you have this idea of where you want to settle a society. And oftentimes it was said you need to be higher up in rocky or pebbly ground, look for freshwater springs that are flowing, don't look for rivers that are more slow, maybe more stagnant. And so in this way, then you also need to, when you find these springs higher up, you need to clear the ground around them, improve the land around it by building structures, directing the water, and still consuming it in moderation, however. So in this idea, when he's getting this inexcusable error, he's really linking to this idea that they should have known better. What are they doing? They should have known better than to go to this low marshy ground in this foreign land and drink not in moderation from this river. And it also kind of links back to some of these ideas of these early Jamestown settlers as kind of dissolute. All they cared about was profit. And it kind of gets back to these ideas of linking them with a lack of improvement of the land, I would argue. So water in this way, and the way they consume water, is constantly tied up in these ideas of civilization, improvement, empire. And so these early Jamestown, Virginia examples really play into that.
Was this association with water being dirty and leading to health problems one reason Puritans built their, quote, city upon a hill?
Yes, totally. So this is something else I study a lot. So this is about theoretical and literal here. So you have to think about the climate in this sense in the Northeast versus the climate in the South. You have all these theories on climate and how it can affect the English body or the European body. The 17th century, they have this humoral theory where you have four main humors in your body: blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. And you need to keep those in constant state of balance. Well, if you go from one climate to a very different one, they believe that that could radically alter you physically and mentally. So you have these Virginia people going down to this more southern portion of America, most of them who are from England, which is way farther north, a very different, more temperate climate. So they perceive the climate as battering them down, and the water is inherently linked to the climate and the natural world. Well, these Puritans and these New Englanders eventually in mass who go to the Northeast, they think that this is going to be more like England and therefore isn't going to affect their bodies as much. So that's kind of the theoretical, but they also literally have this land around them beyond perception that is drier. There's not as much low marshy ground. There aren't swamps there as much. They can't farm as well because of this, but in their minds, they're in a place that's more like England, hence New England, and thus isn't going to harm their bodies the same way. They're going to translate these same ideas to the water around them. And New Englanders especially like to boast about their own moderation, their their pure beliefs, which also can link directly back to these ideas of water. And so in this way, it's both theoretical and literal in that they want in theory to show, in theory, they're going to this climate that's more like their own, and that ascribes to the science of the time. But also literally they're trying to link themselves to a higher calling and a superiority in their way of life, which goes back to, and they're still going with this idea of a city upon a hill. Of course, this city upon a hill falls rather literally in the late 17th century with things like the Salem witch trials and thereafter the kind of depopulation of Boston, relatively speaking. It's definitely this idea of a city upon a hill and clear versus dirty water goes right back to these core beliefs in empire civilization.
Vaughan writes that, quote, after a rather long period of disfavor due mostly to religious strife, attending the spa became a sign of fashion and respectability among English elites by the end of the 16th century. Queen Elizabeth was quickly caught up in the spa craze, visiting Bath, sending for a sample of Buxton's water, and even allowing Mary, Queen of Scots, her prisoner at the time, to attend Buxton, end quote. Vaughan, what would have been the opinion of bathing in water or spas and mineral springs for Shakespeare's lifetime?
In Shakespeare's lifetime, the craze for mineral springs had kind of died off briefly. You have a lot of religious issues there, especially because they're oftentimes linked with Catholic shrines and things like that. So people wouldn't have been frequenting mineral springs, but a lot of it has to do with class. So the upper sorts, as they would have called themselves, the elites, the aristocrats, would have looked at bathing very, very cautiously. A cold bath could shock your senses. A warm bath could permeate you too much. They saw the body as this open vessel was constantly affected by the world around them, kind of like what I was getting into earlier. And so as water becomes this core kind of representation of that natural world, they approach it with much concern. I mean, they also think bad smells could make you sick as well, which is ironic considering early modern London in Shakespeare's time would have been a filthy mess according to our modern sensibilities. This is something I try to really get across to my students a lot. People did not bathe regularly at all. Even by the late 18th century, I have a case of a woman named Elizabeth Drinker who gets in a mineral bath and she doesn't like it. She doesn't get in water again for like 15 years after that.
Wow.
They thought that you could clean linen, clean clothing, that would clean you if you wore that. They also, and we know this is never a good idea, they put a lot of, well, the elites would put a lot of perfume on to try to mask their body odor, which it doesn't work. The perfume's also interesting too, because it came from far off places. So, you know, the sense of it would have projected your power to those around you that you can afford this expensive perfume. But the lower class people would have swam often, not necessarily for health, but for recreation. But the upper sorts would have looked down on them for that as well. They're filthy. What are they doing? They're lower class. They're like the animals. We're supposed to keep them out of this water. So if they're bathing in clean water, they're saying, well, now you're messing up our clean water. If they're bathing in dirty water, they're saying, yeah, you're like swine or animals out there in the filth of the river where you have dead bodies floating around, dead carcasses, urine, feces. People are throwing their urine and feces out in the street. It's then eventually making its way into canals, then eventually making its way into the river. Butchers are throwing all their byproducts out in the street. If one of us were to go back to 17th century London, I think we'd probably retch and throw up the moment we got in there. And so the water in this way was not. It's hard to think about a world where you don't bathe regularly and you see water as a scary thing. And it's hard to bring someone back into that time period, but it really goes all about perception. Something I always say over and over again to my students is that we like to judge people in the past, but people haven't changed where we live in has. So in 200, 300 years, someone's going to be looking at the way we live now and saying, how could they do that? I just don't understand. So for them, bathing and cleanliness just wasn't seen the same as it is now. Now, by the 17th century, they start to have this kind of uptick again in mineral springs, especially drinking the water in small doses and bathing in it. And suddenly, basically in London, taverns especially are discovering all these springs all of a sudden. Oh, look, we have a spring here now. And so it really kicks off mostly though after Shakespeare's time.
Vaughan writes that John Smith came across a hot spring in his first voyage in the New World in 1607, writing, quote, we found a great pond of fresh water, but so exceeding hot, we supposed it some bath, end quote. Vaughn goes on to explain that Smith and his company on that voyage dismissed the value of such a pond. Vaughn, with the well-established fashion of mineral spas and bathing for one's health under Elizabeth I in England, was this dismissive attitude towards what the Native Americans considered miracle waters unique to John Smith and his company because they were there on a different mission? Or was this disregard for the value of bathing just everyone's perspective? I mean, we've said that Elizabeth liked doing this, but was she seen as weird?
Yeah, she was. It was would have been very high, a very high society thing for her to do. And it would have been a very kind of exclusive activity for her. And the thing you have to understand is when she was going to these places and bathing in these places, they were very, very controlled environments. Bath is the perfect example. If you go to Bath, these incredible structures built around these springs, because they believed that that you had to harness the good of nature and expel the savagery and the danger of it. And this is very, you know, if you go to England today, it's a very altered space. There's not hardly anything, quote, natural about it, because they had all these ideas of improving and mastering the natural world. So when she's going to these spas in the UK, in England especially, she's going into separate rooms. Some rooms are warmed. They have fireplaces. Fresh water's pumped in. She has people attending her. She wouldn't have gotten fully naked. She would have had something over her as she's doing this. Now, you get to the New World, and you have men like John Smith coming along. They see these Native American mineral springs, hot springs, cold springs, non-mineral, as savage places that are dangerous because they're still associated with this North American wilderness. They see them as these places that can hurt the European body more than help it, because they haven't been, quote, improved, which is a word you see John Smith saying over and over again in his narrative. And you see all these early Englishmen, because they come over and say, well, Native Americans don't deserve this place because they haven't, quote, improved it, which means they haven't built European style cities. They don't farm the same way we do. They don't have the same road network we do. They don't have livestock. So eventually Europeans are to come, steal this spring and many others from the Native Americans, drive them away. And they build structures around the springs, build water pumps, build roads to them, have regular carriage networks. Now they're safe for the European body because they're trying to make them more like the springs in the old world, like Queen Elizabeth would have attended. And when Queen Elizabeth is attending these springs, ordinary people aren't in spas. Ordinary people aren't going to them. They might work there, but they're not going to them as customers. They're very elite spaces.
What was the response of the medical community in England to the reports of these healing spas? I know the Native Americans were using them medicinally and like to cure ailments. Were there any trips of people from England who went to the New World for the purpose of improving their health?
Okay, so people aren't going to the New World just to improve their health at this time. By the 18th century, you have people going to the West Indies for some of the mineral springs. It's mostly people who are already there. So I'm writing a book right now on German, I'll talk more about it later, but British and Germans, German Hessians, who come over to America during the Revolution. And as they're coming over, they perceive the New World environment as this place that's going to harm them because they've never been. Well, they're oftentimes seeking out these things for their own health, saying, I'm sick, this climate's hurting me. Hopefully the cold bath or the warm bath or a spring will help me in this way. Before the Revolution, you have in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, London philosophers asking for water samples from the Americas so that they can study them and test them according to their, quote, new science. You have, for instance, Alexander Garden in South Carolina sending samples to his benefactors. Now, on the flip side, you also have water from English mineral spring spas making their way for consumption to America. You could buy it bottled. But by and large, before the 18th century, you don't have people coming over. You never have people coming over with the express purpose of just visiting these springs because they have their own in the old world. Now, when they're in the new world and they feel broken down by it, then they are seeking out these springs. It can get kind of shady though. So as people start to see these mineral water as this thing that could possibly healthy, they realize that there's money to be made in this. So I have Benjamin Rush, who was a big Philadelphia scientist, claims that he finds a natural spring in Philadelphia and it's really gross tasting, but he says that's a sign of its, you know, effectiveness. Well, he later realizes the water is coming up through a latrine. So that's why it tastes like this. So people have been drinking this water like, this is good, but it's actually littered with human feces. And then in the early 18th century, you have this, and late 17th, early 18th century, you have this Glastonbury spring, and they're selling this Glastonbury water. But a scientist does an investigation and realizes that they've been putting some kind of animal byproduct in their water to mimic this often disarming smell of sulfuric mineral water. So people are like tampering with this water and they're either misdiscovering it or tampering with it. But it also shows that it's gaining esteem on both sides of the Atlantic.
So they were trying to recreate sulfur water, but they didn't understand what sulfur was. They just thought it needed to smell that.
Yes. And this goes back to our idea of, like I'm saying, with the new river companies in London. It's all about smell and the senses in this way. Now, by the late 18th century, they do start to do all these kind of scientific tests on it where they'll boil it and they'll do it. But in the 17th century, that wasn't happening.
In his paper, Vaughn quotes 16th century sea dog Richard Hawkins, remarking about his first encounters with Native Americans, describing them as natural swimmers, saying that Indians swam, quote, as if they were mermaids and the water their natural element. Vaughn, was swimming considered an unusual activity for people in England? I mean, would William Shakespeare have known how to swim?
No, probably not. I'm not sure if you know how to swim or not, but it was the exception to the rule, very much so. As I mentioned earlier, especially elitist people saw swimming as something, an act of the vulgar or lower sorts. When they attended the spa, they would have been led around by someone. They wouldn't have swam around in the minerals in the spa. They would have lounged. If they walked, they would have, especially at bath, they would have had someone leading them around by the hand. They would have dunked their head underwater sparingly, or they would have gone and had like a spout that emitted water over their heads. Benjamin Franklin is an odd, now he's later, but he could swim, which was seen as very odd at the time. Like, what are you doing? Why are you swimming? But the elites only swam if they absolutely had to, if they like fell crossing a river or something. And people are drowning all the time in the 17th centuries, by the way. Constant reports of people drowning. Oh, a canoe tipped over, they drowned. They fell off horse, they drowned. Because people weren't good swimmers. They were, as I mentioned, they were scared of the water for various reasons. And also, especially in the 17th century England, they tried to keep people out of the water sources for the reasons I've mentioned, whether if they're going to dirty up the clean water or if they're going to sully themselves in the filthy river water, River Thames. And also you have this general kind of idea of nakedness is a bad thing. So if you're swimming around, you're probably bathing. They don't like this idea of being naked. As I mentioned, when they're going into the mineral springs, they're staying bathed. And it's also, and this is getting to my second book project, the fact that he called them mermaids, he's linking them back to this exotic, savage nature that they would have thought of these, or these fantastical creatures like mermaids. So he's even further separating himself from Native Americans. Some other exceptional swimmers in the 17th century were African peoples. They'd often be used to dive for pearls. Or lost goods in the depths of the ocean. They were known for being able to hold their breath for a long time and dive to great depths. So Europeans used them as swimmers for all sorts of purposes. There have been some really interesting publications on that in the last 5 years. Just to wrap it up, white Europeans saw swimming as something that they didn't do, that was this kind of savage act, and they would therefore expect other people like Native Americans or Africans and African Americans to do this, or even lower class people to do this.
I know we would love to explore this topic of water and swimming and understanding the exploration of the New World further. What are some of your books or resources that you can recommend we use to learn more?
Yeah, there's so many good ones. And I had a kind of a hard time with this. I really like James Stevens Curl's Spas, Wells, and Pleasure Gardens of London. It's this extensive volume that goes into encyclopedic detail on all of these different watering places in London. It's not so much argumentative as it is informative, but I would recommend it as a great starting off point for anyone who's interested in learning more about these spaces. I really like Sarah Meacham's Every Home a Distillery, Alcohol, Gender, and Technology in the Colonial Chesapeake, because it gets into these issues of water and alcohol and distillation and fermentation and how this changes from a women's work in distilling alcohol and fermenting alcohol in the men's work as the 18th century progresses, as men try to start taking over these processes because they say, well, this becomes science. And you see the same thing happening. This is concurrent with these mineral spring spas as these gentlemen physicians start to come in and say, okay, you know, we have these old quote wives tales, but we're going to study this because we know better. Troy Porter, maybe my favorite historian. I think he wrote something like 55 books and over 200 articles in his short, he died prematurely. The greatest benefit to mankind in medical history of humanity. He's an incredible writer. He writes with a wit and a prose, which I would almost link back to some 18th century cosmopolite that he wants to be like, basically. He was great. He was famous enough that the BBC actually interrupted their programming to announce his death. I would encourage anyone to look him up. He's written on a wide variety of science, health, enlightenment. Sharon Salinger's Taverns and Drinking in Early America. It's a book I went to a lot when I was writing my first book. She does a great job of getting to conceptions of drinking, health, not just human, you know, bodily health, but societal health. She talks about water. She talks about how different people's prefer different drinking bases and different drinks. That it's a great starting off point for just understanding taverns and society, not just in early America, but in the British Empire at large. And finally, Karl Brinbaugh's. This is an older piece, but was one that was a great inspiration for me as I started thinking about this subject. I remember sitting down in a coffee shop in graduate school when I was supposed to be working on my dissertation on taverns. I found this article and I thought, wow, this is fascinating. And you know, this is in 1946. Nothing had been done about it in early America since then. Brinbaugh published this piece with the William & Mary Quarterly. It's a great, once again, informative exploration of the spa and mineral spring spas and water in colonial America. I would really recommend reading it along with Curl's piece because I think they're good kind of sibling pieces. And he does a good job of showing how colonists are trying to transfer these ideas over to the New World. Various more works, but I thought this is a good mix of kind of academic and popular history for a wide variety of audiences, depending on how deep you want to dive, if you will. Another good pun here in the podcast.
We will link to all of these resources, puns included, in the show notes for today's episode. So make sure you stay tuned. At the end, we'll give the URL for where to find those. Vaughn, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible. So your choice would be in addition to those.
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. No doubt about it.
Oh, good choice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a pretty basic choice. It's not any huge surprise there. It's something, though, I find as a historian, I love because it almost reads like a chronicle of something that really happened. It's the world building's incredible. And I find something new to appreciate it every time I come back to it. I've read it multiple times. It's like an old friend, but it's also something that as I grow older, I associate with different characters in different ways. And I love the movies, too. I'd already read the books, but the first film came out my sophomore year of high school. And so I was able to go to that I'd go opening night every year. So I also associate with those good times in my life. Now, the Hobbit movies are a different issue that we don't need to get into. I don't want to offend anyone, but those are, I love the book, but the Hobbit movies, come on, didn't need to be three, but definitely the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Well, you'd be well set up on your deserted island with that choice for sure.
Yes.
So what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
All sorts of things, actually. My next book project, as I mentioned, is investigating British and Hessian soldiers' perceptions of the New World when they arrived during the American Revolution. Just in a short pitch, it basically argues that they felt like they were fighting the New World environment as much as they were the Americans. And this is a part of the American Revolution that really hasn't been explored. So it's been put on somewhat of a hiatus because of the world around us right now, not easy to travel to an archive in Michigan, but I'm still doing a lot of work on that, diving into every published material I can. I also have a piece forthcoming on Prince William Henry, the first royal to ever step foot in North America. The brat prince son, third son of King George III, arrives in New York City as it's occupied by loyalists. They think he's in the Navy. They think he's come to chase their terrors away. Instead, he is too late to help Cornwallis, and he basically falls into dissipation. I have two articles coming out on early America and Great Britain and how people at the time saw nature, water, and alcohol. Yeah, and I'm working on some other stuff, another piece on Prince William Henry. But largely, my book project is going to be on nature and science and perceptions of the natural world. I've got those other two pieces on water and alcohol and perceptions of the natural world. And then I've got some side stuff on, I just my mermaid book come out. I'm doing some other stuff on mer people where early modern sailors are connecting themselves with mermaid iconography in taverns and on ships. So yeah, I joke around a lot that I'm kind of like a little like raccoon. I chase little shiny things throughout modern world.
Throughout the whole early modern period, yeah.
Yeah, it's the thing I love about this, especially late 17th, 18th century, is anything you're interested in now, you can find precedent then, because we're still so connected to that period. So I teach a class on the Enlightenment, and at the end, the students have to write a paper on some facet of the Enlightenment that they're interested in. And I say, well, what are you interested in now? See what they were doing with it then. So that's what I love about the time period I study. And a big influence for me in studying these mineral springs were in Arkansas, where I live right now. We have two cities devoted to springs, Eureka Springs and Hot Springs. They're just built up around these springs. And that's something that Americans did as they moved west. They just kept doing this over and over again.
Absolutely. Well, those are great resources, and I'm excited to see the projects that you have in the works. We'll look forward to watching them come to fruition, and there will be links in the show notes for today's episode where you can keep up with Vaughn and his work and make sure you get to read those when they're published. Vaughn Scribner, thank you so much for being here this week. Yes. And talking with us about early colonial America and how that impacted Shakespeare. This was a fun conversation. Thank you so much.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Find links to the resources Vaughn mentions in today's episode, as well as archival images, links to primary sources, and more information on how to keep up with Vaughn's forthcoming research publications, all packed into the show notes of today's episode. While you're there, be sure to pick up the free history illustration available inside. You can find all of these things at CassidyCash.com/episode145. That's CassidyCash.com/EP145. Are you excited about becoming a member of That Shakespeare Life? Members get access to our digital history activity kits. These kits work like science labs, but for Shakespeare history. We take things like the game of Naughty, a 16th century card game mentioned in Two Gentlemen of Verona, and teach you how to play it with a supply list, step-by-step instructions, a video tutorial that walks you through what it's supposed to look like when you get it right, and we pack a history guide that lets you explore the real history of the game you're playing, so you're learning while you're doing something fun. Each kit comes with these history guides, printable diagrams, and worksheets, as well as curated links to relevant podcast episodes we've covered here on the show, so you can listen to history experts tell you about the activity while you work on it. There's an entire library of kits, and we add new kits regularly. So when you sign up to become a member, you get access to the whole thing, and you can cook, play, and dance your way through the life of William Shakespeare. Sign up today at CassidyCash.com/member. That's CassidyCash.com/member. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learn something new about the Bard. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.